Since news travels quickly, I know, I will go ahead and ask Section 2 for their first gut-level response of the same question I asked Section 1, which is, what would be your initial response to the idea of moving your second exam to Wednesday of next week instead of Friday this week? Whatever physical damage you cause your fellow classmates when you leave the room, well, that's outside the classroom. But, and if some of you do have strenuous objections to that, you may, in the safety of my office, come and express those objections. But I'm getting the sensation that the majority of the class seems to like the idea. Now, I'm going to give Section 2 the same warning I gave Section 1, except this time it's actually going to be on the recording, so you can enjoy it afterwards. Which is, whatever studying you were going to be doing now and 72 hours from now, or roughly, you know, a 96, I guess. If you're going to pull a 96-hour all-nighter, well, go ahead and still pull it so then you can have the weekend to enjoy yourself. Tuesday morning, when you recover from the weekend, wake up and look at your organic chemistry again. You go, oh, yeah, that's what I learned before I killed all those brain cells. And then you'll have better recall than you would if you go off, take advantage of the possible shift in the exam date, and do nothing until Tuesday night, where all of a sudden you're in the same level of panic you are right now, except all that more time has passed that you've forgotten what we went over, and so it's even harder for you to study. So the reason, there's a couple of reasons for delaying it. One is to give you more time to absorb, for example, this Fisher stereochemistry proof, which this morning I got panicked because there were all these people that had pieces of paper in their hand looking like there was a quiz because they were reading it and studying it. It's like, did I forget to write a quiz? Because people had that mindset. But that if just over the weekend you're just getting into it, I imagine that some of you still have some confusion about the Fisher stereochemistry proof. And so maybe if you have the time this week for you to learn it properly and discuss it in class, it might be beneficial. It also would buy me some time to finish grading these lab quizzes. So it's for your benefit and mine together. So just by a show of hands, how many of you like the idea of putting the test on Wednesday? One hand per person, please. If there's anybody that violently objects to it, I can always give you the exam Friday instead in office hours. But I would want to know way ahead of time so I actually write the exam for that time. All right. So let me ponder it, and I'll tell you for sure Wednesday. How's that? You want to know now? Well, okay, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 2, 4, 6, 8, 32, 4, 6, 7. It's more than half the class, so I'll ask that question again. How many people want the exam Wednesday of next week instead of this Friday? Look, he doesn't even know what's going on. He's like, yeah, next week. Yeah. Go for it, Dr. Gray. It isn't. I'm just letting you think it is. You know, keep them happy enough that they don't revolt. There we go. So, this is still going to have the same information, no more information than it would have. But there is a trade-off, which is I actually got us ahead enough in carbohydrates that this might be the last carbohydrate lecture today. Now, whatever we do after carbohydrates will only be on exam 3. So again, there's not going to be more material for the exam, but we can't stop lecture. We need to keep on moving. And because I've gotten us ahead, I want to keep that pace up so we can get to DNA and some of these topics I never get to because we always run out of time. Well, we're going to start today because what I thought we would do first before finishing the new material is go ahead and have a discussion of the Fisher stereochemistry proof again, so that those of you who have been studying can ask your questions about it. And I'm going to start that off, though, by reminding us there were, I guess if you count the zeroth step, there are 6 steps to the proof. When I ask about it, I'll be thinking of those 5, because we can all just start with the assumption that, yeah, we know it's an aldohexose. But would somebody raise their hand and in a clear, articulate voice explain what the first bit of the proof is, what the significance of it is, which stereocenters established, what are the pitfalls behind this first step? Someone describe that. Yes, Leonardi.
The first step is a guess.
Okay, the first step is a guess. What is the guess? Okay, specifically in the compound D, or glyceraldehyde, that the D configuration is such that when you write the Fischer projection so that the carbonyl is up top and the rest of the molecule follows that normal pattern, that the OH group is going to be on the right. Now, since most of this has been written down before, I'm not going to write an awful lot down unless I give some new presentation or some clarification. Otherwise, you got the handout, you got the notes from last week. So this is your chance for us to have a discussion section, you could say. So the first step was a guess. Why was it a guess?
Because they don't have the technology to.
And do you happen to remember what it was that allowed them to finally make that determination? It was X-ray crystallography. It was being able to take a snapshot of where the positions of the atoms were and then figure out geometrically, okay, where is it, to say, ah, it is R or it is S. And so did he turn out to be correct?
Yes.
All right, so why is that assumption important for the determination of glucose's structure? Because you just told me correctly that the guess was that for glyceraldehyde, that the D form is such that that OH group is on the right. What connection is there between that and glucose?
Once you change the next step, then...
Once you what?
Do the next step.
But even before we take the next step... Oh, I think I know why you might be getting at the next step. What's the next step?
So you do KFC?
Yes.
Kilianni-Fischer
chain extension. What's the importance of that?
From
arabinose, correct? But in general, you can take a sugar and add one more carbon to it. Which portion of glyceraldehyde does not get affected by the Kilianni-Fischer chain extension? The last stereocenter, the one that he guessed was the D configuration. So, if you have the D configuration set and you build a sugar by adding more carbons onto it, then all of the D sugars, including D glucose, have that bottom stereocenter onto the right. Remember that that is a larger picture. We could say there's 16 aldohexoses, but 8 of them are mirror images of the other 8. And chemically, they differ by all of those stereocenters except that last one then. We use that last one to say which one of these two sets is it. So that's the full explanation of that first step, that it was a guess, that they had something to do with the configuration of glyceraldehyde, but because glyceraldehyde can be made chemically related to all the other aldohexoses, that by extension any sugar with a D designation has that bottom stereocenter configured to the right. Now, again, all of that I've said before, that's the only reason I'm not writing it down. Any questions, though? Then, Taki, you were talking about the Kilianni-Fischer chain extension. There's actually a second little wiggle to that second step, the way that I presented it, because we talked about the Kilianni-Fischer chain extension synthesis, but what other way did Fischer demonstrate that glucose and mannose are somehow structurally related to each other? You forgot. Who else would like to jump in? The phenylhydrazones, or more specifically the osazone, which is a double phenylhydrazone. So yes, when you react phenylhydrazine with a sugar, the aldehyde, if it's an aldose, and the next stereocenter down from it, both react to form a hydrazone. Since that stereocenter disappears, it removes the difference between two sugars, the two sugars that are related by the remainder of their stereocenters. So because glucose and mannose only differ on the basis of that top stereocenter, get rid of it and the derivative is the same. And so because the osazone for glucose and mannose were equivalent, that shows their epimers. And because they both were synthesized from arabinose, it shows their epimers with the same stereocenters as arabinose in common between the two. That's step two. Who'd like to explain for us step three? Oh, now come on. You did the first two easy steps. Fen, step three. So the aldaric acid, which what's the difference between an aldonic acid and an aldaric acid? So in the aldonic acid, is it the aldehyde or the bottom of the molecule that gets oxidized? It is only the aldehyde that gets oxidized. And I tried doing a Google search and I found an excellent book that if I spent $150, I could find out the answer to that mechanism. Or there's a variety of papers online I found that I have to buy the subscriptions to. So if I can get myself to a Stanford library or something like that where I can just go look it up instead of pay for it, I'll find the answer to what is that bromine oxidation mechanism. Found all kinds of kinetic studies about it, but nothing without paying for it that I can find the answer to the mechanism. It's nitric acid, though, isn't it, that makes the aldaric acid? One might want to make sure that you know that bromine makes the aldonic acid or nitric acid makes the aldaric acid. What's the third form of derivative I showed you? We did aldonic acids, aldaric acid, and which other thing that same day? Aldetol, which what do we use to make an aldetol? What is an aldetol? Where everything's an alcohol. So how do you get from an aldehyde to an alcohol? Reduce using sodium borohydride. And yes, it turns out I was right. My recall was correct. Sorbitol is another name for glucitol, which is glucose reduced. So related to sugar. So aldaric acid. The aldaric acid of arabinose has three stereocenters to it. Which one of these stereocenters can we automatically write down based on the previous assumptions or steps in the proof? The last stereocenter, because the assumption that the D stereocenter means it's configured to the right. Which stereocenter does the observation that aldaric acid is optically active? The top one we can now establish. Now, Fen, you were the one that suggested this. Why does the top stereocenter have to be configured to the left?
Because if the OH is on the right side, then have a mirror image.
And it has an internal mirror plane. So you use the right term, but a mirror image, if I was getting really fussy, it would mean that you had two molecules. So you have a mirror plane, which means within the same molecule, it's symmetric. So if the two stereocenters shown were configured as shown, the molecule would be meso and therefore optically active. Arabinic acid is, meso and therefore optically inactive. Rather important little prefix there. But arabinic acid is optically active. So it cannot be configured as shown. So that means we know these two stereocenters for arabinose, which, because of that same Chiliani-Fisher chain extension, we now know two stereocenters of glucose. Are there any questions about this third step? Did it make sense when I didn't use so many words to explain it? Just showed you the result? And you notice that this is the main point. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about some side stories, like what a pseudo-stereocenter is, and if it's this, if it's this, if it's this. But the basic argument is it can't be meso, so it has to be that. Now, who would like to tackle step four? Who would like to take a stab at step four? Wow, okay, go ahead.
Okay, so generic and monadic acids are optimally active.
Okay, so just so that we're not staring at empty space, let's write those down. You're saying that just like arabinic acid is optically active, that glucuronic and monaric acids are also optically active. And if we've established two stereocenters so far, we know that both of those acids are going to look something like this. So which of the stereocenters does this part of the proof get us? So let it give her a chance to try. You end up with four different molecules, but which stereocenter, just to jump to the end real quick, is the one that we're going to end up establishing? The third one. Why is it, and again, let her have the chance to answer, why is it that it's going to be that stereocenter that gets determined?
Because I think when you come up with four different molecules, the third one will be able to let us know if it's optimally active or not. So if you're able to find out the meso one, you'll be able to cancel out the other one that has the same one as the meso one.
Correct. What she said was this. That when you pick one of the configurations for stereocenter 3, yes, you do end up with two possibilities as far as what the top configuration is going to be. But if you choose the wrong one for the third stereocenter, if you put it here, then one or the other of the possibilities is going to be meso. Only by putting it there does it reflect with that other one that's up there. You know, the mirror plane wouldn't exist if that third stereocenter wasn't configured that way. Since it can't be meso, because they're both optically active, that means that third stereocenter is on the other side. Now, even myself just listened to that and said, wow, that was a hell of a lot easier than what you said on Friday. But you needed to get all that detail and get it the proper way first, because if I just did the quick and dirty version like this, it might not sink in, or you might not get the big points. So, but I'll say it again. When the third stereocenter is configured as shown, one of the two possible sugars, when oxidized, will be optically inactive. Since they both have that same configuration for the third stereocenter, they both must have the opposite configuration for that point. So, what did I say? When the third stereocenter
is configured as shown. When oxidized, one of the sugars will be optically inactive, and that's because it's meso, since a mirror plane can be drawn through the molecule. Since both glucose and mannose have the same third stereocenter, it must be configured the opposite way for both compounds. That's the fourth step. Questions on that one? Well, I only got one more step. Are you volunteering or got a question?
Question.
No, it will be optically active. Only one of the two is meso. And part of the reason that the discussion became so long last time I presented this is I got really worried about the fact that glucose and mannose are related. Because the way I presented it first is the confusing way. I said, here's four possibilities. And I said, by eliminating one, I eliminate two. And that's where people get stuck. It's like, well, if it can't be that one, why can't it be that one? Because you have to always fall back to the relationship between those bottom three stereocenters. So that's why I divided up the four possibilities into pairs. Because one pair has one configuration for the third stereocenter, the other pair has the configuration for the other. So it's not that both compounds will be meso. If you look at the D sugars, in fact, if you oxidize all the D aldohexoses, galactose is the only one that's going to be meso. But if that one is meso, then what other compound shares the bottom three stereocenters can't be that one either. Glucose and mannose share those three bottom stereocenters. So if you show one configuration of the top one to be wrong, flip the top one around, it's still wrong because of the bottom three stereocenters. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions on that step four? Step five?
I have a
you have a question, okay. This is the oxidized one. So sometimes my wording might get uselessly complicated, but if you're talking about sugars, all aldohexoses are always optically active, period. No, I didn't specify it. Because if you look at it, here's another way you could say it. I choose the third stereocenter like that. If so, I don't know which is glucose and mannose, because he didn't know which way the top stereocenter was positioned.
Well, how do you know it has to be you don't know that?
Put the top one on the right the way that you choose to. Now, it has a mirror plane.
Okay.
So you what?
So you did assume something at the top part, and you assumed that it was on the...
I assumed both were going to happen. And I don't know which one is glucose, and I don't know which one's mannose. But since they both must be one of those, if it's wrong, it's wrong for both. You want me to try it again? Here, let me try it this way. I have a blue pill and a red pill, right? We'll make this matrix style. Okay? Let's say that I got my twin over here. Okay? And who's also holding out two pills, a red one and a blue one. You don't know which one is good, which one is bad, which will take you deeper down the rabbit hole, and which one will keep you just blissfully ignorant, for those of you who've seen the movie. Okay? Now, let's change that scenario a little bit. Let's say that one of my twins, both pills are good. The other twin, one pill is bad, one pill is good. All right? So you would want to go with whichever twin only gives you good choices, right? So for one twin, you don't know which one's bad, but you know one's bad, so you're not going to go that way no matter what. It's a terrible example, but it's the same situation. Hey, I just thought of that on the spot. That's not bad for trying to just
on the spot come up with something.
No, it's not that good at all. Oh.
But did that make sense at all?
I think so.
Then it worked.
But that's the point. That here's...
Let me ask you this. Which one of these is glucose?
I have no idea.
That's the point. So if I say this one is wrong, they're both wrong. If I say this one is wrong, they're both wrong. Because you don't know which is which, but they both are related by the bottom three stereocenters. And since that doesn't change between the pair of choices, the top stereocenter, no matter what it is, the bottom three are the same. Since they have to be correct, if one molecule is shown wrong, both molecules are wrong.
All right.
Keep chewing on it.
I'll figure it out.
Okay.
Step five. Oh, Anthony, there we go. Okay. Out of the 16 sugars, how many of them, if you remove the top and bottom functional group, are rotationally symmetric? Mannose. And that's the only one. What did I just say? Rotationally symmetric. What in the world does that mean? Is this shape rotationally symmetric 180 degrees? No. If you turn it 180 degrees, what happens? This is the look before you leap example. Oh, you're here now. Is this C2V?
Or
this object? That's what I was trying to remember on the spot the other day. Of course, we'd have to catch everybody else up to what point groups are, but if you think about it, because I still have my group symmetry book somewhere.
No, I have one.
Probably the same one I've got. We'll both try to figure out if that's C2B. For everybody else in English, it is not symmetric when rotated 180 degrees. Now, what about this shape? You know, if the first one's going to be no, the second one's got to be yes, right? When I turn it 180 degrees, what do I get? The same thing back again. So it is rotationally symmetric 180 degrees. What does this have to do with the sugars? Because if somehow I could swap Those groups by rotation, that has exactly the same form as this disk I just drew. And if, in fact, you fill in these with OH groups, this becomes the molecule mannose. Mannose is the only sugar that has this kind of configuration, where if you turn it 180 degrees, now let me think about that. Wait. It's not. There is one more. Star Wars line. There is another. It's a trap. Is that one the rotationally symmetric? Yes, it is. But mannose is the only one that's rotationally symmetric that has that configuration of bottom, the three bottom stereocenters. Why does all this matter whether it's rotationally symmetric or not? Because for the sake of argument, even if this is not maybe necessarily how it all occurred chronologically, assume that Fischer had all 16 sugars to play with and oxidized them all. The one that glucose made when it oxidized was the same as another sugar was. But that's not physically possible for mannose, because the reason that you have those two possibilities for glucose is, imagine I start with the stereocenters for glucose and nothing else. But I take this two different directions. In one case, I take exactly that same sugar and put the aldehyde and alcohol the way we normally would. But I could also do it the opposite way. There are ways chemically to do this. That's not really the point. The point is just to demonstrate why would two possibilities occur. Because when you oxidize either of these compounds, they both turn back into the same aldehyde acid. Because the top and the bottom of the aldehyde acid are the same. Well, if you made them different by taking them back down to the sugar level, that means two different sugars would be involved. One of them is D-glucose. The other one is L-gulose. But as I showed you in a slightly different way last time, taking mannose, which is rotationally symmetric, here's the point. Whether I write the rest of this like this or like this, I'm going to get the same answer. Because is that mannose? Is that still mannose? Yeah, it is. Now look at this sugar over here. That's gulose. Turn it upside down. Flip the functional groups around. It becomes actually, that's a bad example. If you flip the If you flip the functional groups around, then rotate it, it would have done what I wanted, which is to show you that it's glucose. But to finish the way I did this the first time, if I make these two possibilities, you know what I did do? I proved that right, left, right. I proved by turning this upside down that it really is L-gulose, that I didn't do it wrong. Let's do that. Because gulose is supposed to be right, right, left, right, but this is L-gulose, so it's left, left, right, left. So I did do that correctly. What I'm now going to show you, though, is if we do the same trick with mannose that there I've written the functional groups the way we're supposed to, and we can clearly see that it's mannose. Now I'm going to write the functional groups the opposite way, which for the case above gave me a different sugar. But when I take this and now put it the right way on paper, we can see left, left, right, right, that's still mannose. So no matter which end I put the aldehyde on, I get the same sugar, which is why it's the only sugar that when you oxidize it gives you that particular aldehyde acid, which is why that one is mannose. That's the last step of the proof. And that admittedly is the most complicated of the steps, brain power-wise. Because even with struggling, it seemed like everybody kind of at least accepted the results of step 3 and 4. But this one, you're still looking at like, what the world's he talking about? That's the sense I'm getting. Would you think that I have the correct sense? Okay. Questions? Then I'll open up for questions on Wednesday, once you've studied this proof one more time. Wednesday will be your last chance for questions about this topic, to encourage you to study on time, even if we delay the exam. I will not answer more questions after Wednesday on this topic. Questions for the moment, then. Then, switching gears, we were working on disaccharides, correct? I think we wrapped up class last time with trying to make an exhaustively methylated derivative of a sugar. But I also mentioned that there's this thing called the Tollens test. I don't know if I called it by name. Might have said the silver test. I called it Tollens. Well, that's what it is. It is the Tollens silver mirror test. And why is it called the silver mirror test? Because it makes a mirror. I mean, old school mirrors were made by bits of silver, highly polished, because polished silver is quite reflective. You can perform the formation of a mirror chemically by mixing a solution of formaldehyde or any old aldehyde you want, wash it on the inside of a test tube, wash it with this reagent, and you're going to get silver film, silver, solid silver deposited as a very thin layer all on the inside of your test tube. It's actually sometimes purposely done to make mirrored objects in that way. What's going on here? Take a solution of silver nitrate and ammonia. Chem 1C class, what would happen next? Ooh, not yet. It will. What would happen if I added hydrochloric acid at this point? Silver chloride would precipitate. But if I had a silver compound like silver chloride, if I take it out of acid and put it into basic conditions and put it in ammonia, that silver salt dissolves. Because it forms a complex ion. It forms this. To do it correctly, I need to do it like this. There we go. Make it a true transition metal complex. So this silver ammonium complex, I forget the proper name of it, is an oxidizing agent. And the exact mechanism of this is not important, but what will happen is if you take an aldehyde and you react it with the toluenes, you get a carboxylate, which is oxidation. This is not a balanced equation, but showing you that the product is silver metal. So silver is the oxidizer. Remember, what oxidizes gets reduced. So silver steals the electron from the aldehyde somehow, causing it to oxidize. Now, if we have a ketone, though, there's no reaction. Why? No hydrogen. We're back to Chem 12B. Remember when we had PCC or any kind of oxidizing agent? Aldehydes, because of the ability to form hydrates, can be oxidized. Ketones, even if you can form a hydrate, you can't make another bond because it's already got four connections to it. You need the ability to remove a hydrogen from that carbonyl position in order to be able to oxidize. Why is this important? Well, because historically, if we didn't know if we had an aldehyde or a ketone, we could show that we had one or the other by making a hydrazone. So I realized in preparing your second lab quiz that last time I taught Chem 12C, I did focus a little bit more on this topic. Whether or not I end up testing on this topic is not important. It's the fact I didn't cover the topic, which I'm going to do now. This is 2,4-dinitrophenylhydrazine, which when you react it with something like acetone, a little music always makes the lecture go by better, right? So, if you got rid of the phenyl group, what kind of derivative is this? Hydrazone. Remember, we've already seen these hydrazones in the phenyl hydrazone, it is the ozazone. But this is a derivatized hydrazone, and its short name is DNP. DNP derivatives, very crystalline. Very isolatable, means they're great for doing exactly these melting point tests that I've referred to in the past. So it also lets you know if you have an aldehyde or a ketone, because those are the types of functional groups that can make this. But just on the basis of the DNP derivative alone, you don't know, is it an aldehyde or is it a ketone, except if you do the toluenes test. The toluenes test lets you distinguish between an aldehyde and a ketone, unless you have a sugar. More generally, unless you have an alpha hydroxy group. That'll give you a false positive. Why? False positive means the result says one thing that you know is not true. Because what I just showed you is that normally the toluenes test is positive for aldehydes, negative for ketones. I didn't say it so clearly, so let me write that down. So back up here where I mentioned the toluenes test. It is used, in one sense, to distinguish between aldehydes and ketones.
Why? Because aldehydes can be oxidized and ketones can't. The Tollens reagent's an oxidizing agent. It oxidizes ketones, or aldehydes. It doesn't oxidize ketones. You see if it happens or not because of the silver film produced. So it's a qualitative test for a functional group. But even after I'm saying now that's the way it's used and that's useful, I'm saying it's got one drawback to it. That a ketone that it's not supposed to react with because it's not oxidizable, it gives that positive indication for. It makes the silver, which is only supposed to happen for aldehydes. But my question was, why is this happening? That's partly it. Because the primary alcohol by itself wouldn't react with the reagent. You actually need a carbonyl. But didn't we already see how in basic conditions, which if you have ammonia around, that usually implies you've got basic conditions. Didn't we already see how you could double tautomerize and turn this into an aldehyde? That's how glucose and fructose are related. So in solution, this tautomerizes. Once it does, it oxidizes, gives you the false test. Why does this matter? It matters for a reason. I really need more than the 2 minutes left to go through. So I think, yes, I did see a pig fly, because I think I'll end lecture early today. I'll leave it with a cliffhanger. Oh, so what happens next? Tune in next time.